Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today. One of the biggest controversies in Annapolis is around the issue of wind power. Governor Martin O'Malley has made a big deal of creating renewable energy as a major source of our energy systems in the state of Maryland, and has proposed building this massive wind turbine energy system in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Maryland. And it has caused quite a bit of controversy, as you can well imagine. Some people see this as the wave of the future, the only way that we can harness energy and go to a carbon-free future. Others say, as we've had in this program before, and some who are environmentalists have said that this is a boondoggle, that it is not the way to go, that we don't know what effect it's going to have on the ocean floor. We don't know how it's going to we're going to take the energy from the eastern shore and hit it to the rest of Maryland. Others are saying that this is going to cost too much money. And others are saying, though, that this is the only way we can go, that we have to build a system and a new grid, and that this is the key to the future of energy in the state of Maryland and the United States of America. So we are going to talk about that during the course of this hour. Jay Hancock, who is business columnist for the Baltimore Sun, has written a piece on March 27th, my sister's birthday. Not that it makes any difference.
I'll dedicate it to her.
Dedicated to her. saying this, we have to stop Martin O'Malley's offshore wind folly now, not later, and just kill it. It's not worth it. Brad Huebner is executive director, is that right?
Yeah.
Of Environment Maryland, who clearly looks at the other side of this, saying wind power is the way we have to go if we're going to survive in the future. So, gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you both in the studio here.
Good to be here.
I'm Mark. Nice. Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you here. So since you started this ruckus, no, you didn't really start this ruckus, but Jay, but you did and kind of lay out why you think the wind energy proposal doesn't make much sense economically, basically what you were saying. So why don't you lay that out and then I hear from Brad about why he thinks it does make some sense.
Yeah. Maryland needs more generation, and Maryland needs a renewable energy portfolio. So on that premise, I'm totally with the people that are talking about ways to upgrade Maryland's energy delivery. I just think, and many people have looked at this, and smart people have spent lots of time and found that offshore wind is probably the single most expensive way to convert Maryland's carbon-based economy, Maryland's coal-based, polluting electricity generation economy that we have now, into a more friendly, environmentally economy. Offshore wind is just really, really expensive. The ocean is a hostile environment. It's still a developing, you know, there are lots of facilities in place, but to a large degree, we're still figuring out how to do this and figuring out how to the most economical way to do this. And in Maryland's case, we've had a study that was done that was commissioned by O'Malley's own Public Service Commission that looked at alternatives. Back when O'Malley was talking about ordering the utilities to buy electricity from some kind of generation plant, it's clear we're going to need new generation plants. O'Malley commissioned the study. It was very – the PSC, I should say, commissioned it. It was very expensive. What they came up with is that the best way to wean ourselves off of these coal plants is to build natural gas-fired plants. Natural gas, of course, is a fossil fuel, but it emits far less pollution and carbon dioxide than the coal plants. And what they found to be the most expensive alternative, you know, barring some, you know, ridiculous fairy tale alternatives such as, you know, paving Talbot County with solar panels, you know, barring that, the most expensive alternative was offshore wind. And they found it to be expensive to ratepayers. They found it to have a negative economic impact, even weighing all the side effects that promoters talk about for offshore wind. And it just seems to me that the governor has this alternative of natural gas staring him in the face, which some people think could even lower electricity bills in Maryland. And yet he's looking at this other project because, I mean, who knows what his motives are. But it's a big profile project, and he's getting a lot of attention for it. And I think he's drawn to the glamour of it and isn't looking hard enough at the price tag.
So, Brad Huebner, I mean, the price tag has become, I think, one of the main issues here. We'll cover a few more, but how is Jay Hancock's sense of what's going on incorrect or correct?
Well, the biggest thing that I think there is incorrect there is that the report from a few years ago that you're referencing, Jay, was not a report studying how to get to a carbon-free economy or how to reduce the environmental impacts of electricity. It was a report that was commissioned after the rate caps were ended and our utility bills doubled overnight. People were furious that deregulation was a crazy scheme that was a total ripoff for consumers. And the legislature reacted by enabling this study that says, okay, what now? Now that we've deregulated, how do we bring those costs down, come up with different market structures to have a more stable electricity system in the state of Maryland? And in that context, offshore wind, a more expensive and environmentally friendly proposal is certainly not your top pick at all. It is more expensive, especially in the short term, perhaps not in the long term. Jay, first off, let me say that I love the fact that you have not given in to the hype on deregulation and have seen straight through that and told the facts on that. I have immense respect, and I love your column. But that was the point of that report, and now the question is different. We need to get more renewable energy and cleaner energy so that global warming doesn't have an even greater impact on our children's lives than it's already certain to do. I agree that if it's based on price alone, wind power is not a good deal. I mean, there is a benefit to having stable prices because the wind is free, right? You know, once you sign a contract, a long-term contract with the wind power company, you know what that's going to cost for 25 years. They're guaranteeing you electricity at a set price. No fossil fuel plant can do that. Coal plant's not going to do that. Natural gas plant's not going to do that because they don't know what they're going to have to be paying for these fossil fuels, for their fuel. The price goes up and down wildly, and so they can't guarantee the price. So for wind, even though you're paying a little bit more right now, it's a steady price. So it's kind of a hedge against the volatility of fossil fuels. There's an economic benefit to that. With that said, however, that alone is not enough to say wind power is the right thing to do, for sure. But you add in the job creation that will come from this, and you add in the environmental benefits, and those three things together make this the right thing to do.
Well, let's parse this a little bit. I mean, is there any disagreement that the amount of money it would cost up front to build this is huge? We're talking billions of dollars. I've seen estimates anywhere from $2.5 to $20 billion to build these 200 stations off the
lots of figures get thrown around.
So it's really confusing about the figures because they really are all over the place.
Don't confuse the number that people throw out is the capital cost just to put up the windmills.
Right.
Dig the foundations, 100 feet under the surface of the ocean and do all this other expensive stuff. And that, the common shorthand, is more than $1 billion.
$1.5 billion.
One of the points I tried to make
over the column.
Well, however long it takes to build a thing.
Well, it's finite. I mean, the thing about renewable energy is the fuel is free, but the equipment is more expensive. This is high-tech stuff. So all of the cost is up front.
But nothing is free in this world.
Well,
I mean,
the wind.
Not all the cost is up front. O'Malley's own Public Service Commission found that this is going to cost Maryland ratepayers multiples of $1.5 billion over the 20 or 25-year life of the contract. These are going to be financed with mortgages. The mortgages have to be paid off. The mortgages are going to have interest rates. There's going to be maintenance on these facilities that's going to get beyond, let's stipulate, the $1.5 billion just for the sake of argument, although I suspect that even that's a low figure. But you're going to have you're going to be paying for the maintenance and for the financing of these things over what's the life of the contract we're talking about now is 25 years.
25 years. So it's the financing. I mean, most of the cost is up front for the equipment. But then the wind company has to spread that out over time through financing.
And the Public Service Commission found that it could be for a 20-year contract. It would have been $8 billion.
Can we talk about those projections, though?
Out of Maryland ratepayers' pockets over a 20-year period.
Because they're no longer saying that, and there's a good reason why.
Well, they revised that downward, so now it's $4 billion. But your initial point was it's a lot of money, and I think we're probably both agreeing on that. It's billions of dollars.
And so where are you disagreeing with that, Brett Huebner?
Well, sure, it's a lot of money. There's no question. But it's a 25-year deal to produce. This is the biggest chunk of renewable energy we could build. That's why we're excited about it. These wind turbines are big. They're a lot bigger than what you can put in the mountains. You know, I'm a supporter of wind power up in Garrett County, but it's pretty limited, the number of places you can put it and the size of the turbines. Here we're talking about massive turbines that you can put out in the ocean. We're blessed in the Mid-Atlantic with a couple of things. One is very steady wind coming off the ocean, and two is the seafloor goes out very gradually. So you can go 10, 15 miles out, and it's only 50 feet deep. So it's possible to put these wind turbines out there and to put very big wind turbines out. So the wind farm we're talking about would power about 135,000 homes. As compared to up in Garrett County, there's one wind farm now. It would power about 12,000 homes. So it's about 10 times bigger. That's why we're interested in this, because it's a very big chunk of clean power. The difference I have is on the projections. And I mean, Jay, you alleged in your column that it was under political pressure from the governor that the PSC changed its projection. It's simply not true. There are amendments to the bill, which has clarified the original intent and has ensured that it won't hit those top price projections that were initially put out there. So, I mean, it's very unfortunate that after the first introduction of the bill, the story was this could cost homeowners $9 a month. And it was never the governor's intention, and we didn't think the way that the bill was structured that would happen. So clarifying amendments were added to the bill to ensure that that is not at all possible. But that, you know, once that number's out there, people are scared, and it's hard to get beyond it.
Well, let's talk about the monthly cost, because that really brings it home to what it means for the average guy. The spread of the estimates has been $8 or $9 a month, I guess, on the high side for what
on each person's bill
for what Brad correctly says was the initial PSC estimate that they then revised to reflect different parameters of the bill, and Nazarian explained that to me and the governor's people.
Who's the head of the Public Service Committee.
Thank you. So that all looks kosher. At the low end, we've got estimates of what? Less than a dollar a month.
92 cents.
For some people. And now the governor is getting pushback from the legislature on the cost, and he's now tweaking his proposal and putting in requirements that the added cost for ratepayers be no more than $2 a month. Initially, it was going to be for the first year. Now the governor is saying, okay, it'll be over the life of the contract. I am highly skeptical of those numbers, but I thought we should throw them out. I thought we should throw them out there just so people can get an idea of the magnitude of what we're talking, what it might mean on their bills.
The best guess is $1.44 a month in the first year, in 2016, when these things begin delivering power. The estimate is this will cost the average homeowner $1.44 per month extra. Now, that's no small thing. I'll be the first to acknowledge that's a big deal, right? It goes down from there. That's the 2016 price. Every year it'll get a little cheaper as compared to fossil fuels. The expectation is fossil fuels get more expensive. In the long run, wind has a benefit. But again, there is the jobs component. There is the environmental component. I mean, look, one thing that really scares me economically is the price of food. Global warming will make weather more unpredictable and irregular. It's going to be harder to grow food, and food will become more expensive. That is an economic impact on every family in the world.
Right.
You want prices to go up? Do nothing.
Well, let me ask this question. I'm I mean, wind power is, we've had this debate about wind power on the show many times over the last 18 years. And clearly, you know, you read George Monbiot's work, which we'll talk about in a minute, in Britain. He is a huge fan of it and talk about how Britain can be a energy producer with wind. And there's a big argument going on in Britain about that at this moment. And Denmark has a lot of wind, but a lot of that wind is exported to Scandinavia, not used in Denmark itself. And so, so as I, we'll come to that with the kind of global picture, but one of the things you said, Brad, and I just to kind of explore this for a minute, we said that this investment brings energy to 135,000 households in Maryland, but there are almost 2 million households in Maryland.
And what is so, what is that based on? What capacity is that based on? Is that based on 600 megawatts?
I think it's 600, yeah.
One of the problems with wind is it only blows half the time. Even the best of these projects run at about 45 or 50% capacity. So we're not talking about 135,000 households.
No, but that's factored into that number. That's certainly factored into that number.
I don't know. Here's the thing. BGE's load alone is more than 7,000 megawatts at peak load in the summertime. We're talking about building 600 megawatts offshore, which will, as a practical matter, deliver 300 megawatts. It's a drop in the bucket, but it's really expensive. Nobody's saying, well, lots of people are saying, you know, morons are saying that, that climate change is not a problem. People who who worry that this project might be too expensive, many of them, including environmentalists, agree that climate change is an issue and we need to do something about it. The argument is that this isn't the most cost-effective way to do it.
So, Brad, so going back, I will admit that I've always kind of leaned towards wind and on renewable energies as a way we have to go for the future of the planet. The question is, let me just throw this thing out. One of the things I read in the report from the University of Maryland Center. Why am I blocking on the name of the center? But the center that did the original study of wind in how wind power would work, SEER, in University of Maryland, said that because of the way Maryland's situated, that these wind turbines could serve parts of the eastern shore, but nobody else. But that if the wind turbines were further north, if they were off the coast of Delaware, let's say, and we had a regional approach to this, then the wind that could go from New Jersey to Maryland could attach to the grid and really affect the urban world of Philadelphia and Baltimore. Could really affect major households, numbers of households. But because of the way this is placed, because we're dividing up by states, and everybody trying to get on the combat each other, that this does not become as an effective resource as it could.
Well, we absolutely need a regional approach. Delaware is going ahead. They already have a contract like this. We're basically doing what they did already. And then Virginia's talking about it, North Carolina, New Jersey. And New Jersey's talking about 1,000 megawatts, twice the size of what we're talking about here. So, we need a little vision here to build something, build a lot of projects that will help the whole region. Now, Maryland is in a sub-region of a 14-state electricity grid. There's a big, transmission grid, covers parts of 14 states. We're in the most constrained sub-region, meaning there's a lot more need for power than there is generated power. We import a lot of power through old transmission lines that are basically extension cords to West Virginia and Western Pennsylvania.
That's true.
Yeah.
You agree with that, right, Jay?
And so this helps the entire state in correcting that imbalance.
But in the category of cost, it would help the state with significant new transmission infrastructure. The constrained area that Brad is talking about is Central Maryland. And it's costing us lots and lots of money because of the grid system that Brad described. There are surcharges and basically taxes that go on when you're importing lots of electricity. And one of the problems with offshore wind is It's going to be offshore. It's going to be off Maryland. And the cost that we're talking about, the $2 a month or the $5 a month or the 89 cents a month or whatever it is not going to be the whole cost. When O'Malley talks about, oh, we can do this for $1.5 billion, it's really not going to benefit Maryland unless we need to replace these extension cords that are powering Maryland, and we're going to have to build some transmission from the offshore wind facility, including on the eastern shore. The MAP program, that's another – the MAP line on the eastern shore, which, by the way, is very controversial over there. That's another $1 billion all by itself. Not just Marylanders would pay for that. That would be socialized across the whole grid, but that would be another cost, part of which we would have to meet.
But we don't need that for this project. We do not need the new major transmission line to do this project. There would be needs for some upgrades for regional distribution and substations on the eastern shore. All of that is baked into the price. All of that is under the cap.
There's going to be more transmission costs here. We're talking about this Google line that would run up and down the East Coast as a regional line. That's going to be paid for by ratepayers. And the problem is that the offshore wind project is not going to help the transmission, the constrained electricity market in central Maryland. To address that directly, we need to build combined cycle gas, natural gas-fired plants here on land close to the market where there's already transmission. That would increase the supply. That would make the price go down. It would address some of these outrageous capacity taxes that the PJM grid is putting on us. And it might even make electricity prices go down.
And it would do very little for global warming or to create a new manufacturing hub for an emerging new industry.
So, but let me ask this question, Brad. Before we go to break here, we can pick up after break. If, for argument's sake, maybe you'll disagree with this completely, but if for argument's sake, what Jay Hancock is just laid out here in terms of the limitations of wind and the other issues that are involved and will evolve around guaranteeing energy and energy that's not overly expensive for the rest of the population, that this answers only a piece of the problem. And it is expensive, but answers a piece of the problem. But how about how what Jay is saying, how this all fits into the larger question of how we get energy to the rest of the state of Maryland?
Well, the number one energy solution that we should be doing way more than we've ever done on is energy efficiency and conservation. We need to use less power. It makes economic sense to upgrade these old buildings so we're not wasting energy right out the window. So that's number one for sure, and let's redouble our efforts and more so on that. Beyond that, we need to gradually build the renewable energy sources, including some clean biofuels that in the long run can be a very big part. Solar will be a significant part, especially in the long run, and we need to start now ramping up in other clean renewable fuels. So yeah, we're not going to shut down the coal plants overnight by any means. But we need to really keep at it and use every opportunity. The wind is blowing as we speak, and we're just letting it blow.
In the category of cutting use, a great example is Baltimore Gas and Electric's Peak Rewards program, which you may be familiar with. This is when they put a switch on your air conditioner to shut it off for a few minutes on really, really hot days, and they pay you a bonus for that. I forget how it works. They cut your rates or something. But there's a financial incentive to do that. BGE, this is, as demand response programs go, that's the term of art for this, demand response, getting people to use less at peak times when electricity is really expensive. BGE has worked really hard at it, but as demand response programs go, it's a drop in the bucket. We could do so much more. And yet, with this program that's been going on for, 3 years now, I guess, BGE is going to get as much megawatt response as we're talking about building offshore with all this effort and all this expense for tons less money. BGE is getting the same amount of capacity just by getting people to turn off their air conditioners for a half hour or an hour on a hot August day. And to me, that seems like the much more efficient and smart way to go to get our way out of this problem that we both agree is a problem.
So a response. Take us to break and we'll come back.
We need to do all those things and more. Period. Yes, that's been a very successful program. I mean, that's the reason we might not need to build these new transmission lines to West Virginia, because that program has been successful. So we should push that even bigger. And we need to do wind power, and we need to do more solar, and we need to develop a new generation of biofuels.
We'll pick up on this when we come back from this very brief break. We're talking with, you just heard Brad Huebner, who's Executive Director of Environment Maryland, and the Baltimore Sun business columnist, Jay Hancock, as we look at the wind power proposal that's causing a huge controversy in the state legislature that Governor Martin O'Malley proposed. As you listen to this, it's being debated and may go to vote next week if it gets that far. We'll talk more about that when we come back, so stay with us.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and I'm here with Jay Hancock, business columnist of the Baltimore Sun, who wrote a piece, Stop O'Malley's Offshore Wind Folly Now, Not Later. In other words, it's put a kibosh on it, don't even think about it, put it out the window. And Brad Huebner, Executive Director of Environment Maryland, is one of the key lobbyists in lobbying Annapolis and the state of Maryland to build wind power for the state of Maryland as a key to our future. So when we left off, I mean, you said something as we were going to break, Brad. Let me push a little bit further, which is that we may not need transmission lines. Isn't that exactly what we do need, though, in the future? Is more transmission lines, rebuilding our grid, making this a smarter grid for the state, for the region, for the nation, if we're going to survive the future?
Yeah, we absolutely will need to restructure and upgrade our transmission system. The proposals currently on the table, though, there's one by PEPCO and one by First Energy that are designed to link up coal-fired power plants in West Virginia and Western Virginia with East Coast customers. You know, there are underutilized. You know, there are coal plants in Appalachia that are not operating at full capacity, and those power plant owners would love nothing more than to be able to connect with customers up and down the East Coast. Those would undermine all of our efforts to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions from the electricity sector, and they'd be expensive and you know, not as good as small local solutions. So. We're strongly opposed to those. In the long run, with this first offshore wind turbine, you know, they'll need to upgrade substations and some of the shorter transmission lines, and that's all part of the project already. It's part of the proposal. If we build this, we're talking about 2016 or so it goes online, and then New Jersey and Virginia maybe 2020 something, we build another wind farm offshore, and there's, you know, more wind coming in from other places and a whole different generation scheme. We need to reorient our transmission grid to serve that. But that's not the first job right now.
The first job is what?
Build this first project, an offshore wind, in addition to the other things that we're doing, energy efficiency and other clean energy sources.
So one of the things you argue, Jay, and you've made this argument early in this program, you made it in your columns, is that we need to have gas-fired fuel plants as the cheapest way to go as opposed to more nuclear or as opposed to coal-fired plants. So let's take that for a minute. Let's look at that argument for a minute and talk about where that takes us. I mean, you take us here for a minute, but Brad, and I want you to talk a bit about, now there's a lot of controversy over this. I mean, Heather Mazur in the state legislature is battling fracking, and battling the new drilling in Western Maryland for gas, because of what it's done into New York, Pennsylvania, Colorado, Wyoming. I've seen it myself in Wyoming. I was at somebody's house where they turned the faucet on and fire came out of the faucet just down the road from my friends on the Indian Reservation, on the Arapaho Reservation. There's some real issues here. So let's wrestle with that for a minute and how that ties into where we are now in the battle in Annapolis over wind.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought it up because it really deserves points to be made on both sides. Here's what I like about natural gas. the plants are cheap to build. We can build a plant with twice the capacity of these windmills that we're talking about putting offshore at perhaps half the cost in terms of getting electricity in to power Maryland's economy. Natural gas is a fossil fuel, but it's virtually pollutant-free. There is pollution in it. There are trace amounts of mercury and other stuff. But I think Brad would agree, compared to the coal plants, it's vastly preferable. There is carbon dioxide emissions when you burn natural gas, but they're much less. What did I say in the column?
40%.
40%. A huge reduction in carbon emissions. I think that natural gas plants are a good sort of halfway house between where we are now and a carbon-free economy. They can get us over the step that it's going to take to get these totally carbon-free technologies down to a cost where they really are self-supporting and economically efficient. Right now, all over the world, carbon-free energy is subsidized in one way or another by ratepayers or by taxpayers or somebody. The technology is evolving. I hope we'll get there. But right now, they're still really expensive. Gas seems like a way to fill in the gaps in Maryland's generation portfolio and end these constraint taxes that we're paying here in Central Maryland, which is part of why electricity is so expensive. However, part of the case for natural gas, at least the economic case, is based on these vast new supplies of shale gas that are being opened up by, you know, what's, as you say, is described as fracking,
right,
which is heavily pressurized water
with
weird chemicals in it going underground, breaking up the shale formations, freeing up the gas and making it available. There's no question that the economic potential is quite amazing, and not just in the United States. This is bringing down the cost of natural gas worldwide. There are legitimate environmental questions about what damage is going on. What are these chemicals? What's it doing to the watershed? It needs regulation. I'm not an expert, but I'm hopeful that eventually it can be regulated. I think there's a good environmental case to be made for putting up with some environmental damage to get natural gas for the reasons I just described. It's so much better than coal. It's here. It's not imported. We don't have to buy it from the Saudis. I think there are lots of positive arguments to be made. The environmental, you know, what's it doing to the watershed absolutely has to be looked at.
Brad.
Well, it's not coal. I like that. We've been choking on coal for 100 years, and it's caused
right.
a lot of
I think everybody in this room
disease.
Agrees coal has – we have to end coal. Coal is not doing anything for us.
And
maybe we'll come back. Maybe you don't agree with
that. No, coal sucks. Get rid of it.
Yeah. Can't do it overnight, but absolutely. We need to do what we can to get off coal. And natural gas, 40% cleaner than coal. Is that clean enough? Is that really going to solve the problems we're trying to solve here? I think not. Obviously, it's better. But then let's talk a little bit about the hydraulic fracturing. You're digging a mile deep and then turning the drill bit somehow horizontally, drilling 2 or 3 miles more,
right.
pumping down high-pressure water and chemicals. It surprises me that it works, but evidently it does. And they are doing a lot of this in Pennsylvania right now.
New York, and, Wyoming, Colorado.
Oh, yeah. They've been doing it out in the Rockies for a while. But it obviously that's quite risky. I mean, there have been major pollution problems already. Doing something like that, you want to talk about the wind turbines being high tech. I mean, this is a crazy drilling operation. Problems will continue. Supply disruptions will happen. The current projection for natural gas to be cheap for the rest of our lifetimes is absurd, especially if we go around and build a whole bunch of new natural gas-fired power plants. that is going to, you know, increase the demand for natural gas at the same time as we continue to experience inevitable supply hiccups. It's not the good deal that its backers say it is.
So, Brian, let me ask you this, and then come back. I want to know then what's the alternative? I mean, what do we do? I mean, what do we do to supply clean energy to America? I mean, that's a huge issue everybody's wrestling with. Well, what do we do? I mean, how do we get to the point where we're not relying on fossil fuels? Is it even possible not to do it without gas?
The best thing that's happened in the energy world is reductions in our consumption. And that's happened both because of the types of programs that Jay described earlier to increase our efficiency, and recently because of the economy. Can we, as the economy rebounds, sustain that? I think the best thing that Governor O'Malley has done on the energy front is actually not his big proposal on wind power, but it's his big aggressive goal on energy efficiency, saying that we are going to use 15% less electricity by 2015 than we did when he announced that. I think it was 2009. That's bold. That's exactly what needs to happen. That's number one. So as we hold the demand constant or reduce that slightly, then we gradually bump up the clean, truly clean electricity generation sources and we can very gradually turn down those coal plants.
I guess the reason I bring that up, I mean, I know we're debating wind here and whether we should build these turbines off the coast of Maryland, and that's the debate of the moment inside the State House in Annapolis, and it affects the Eastern Shore very deeply because that's where, if we did this, that's where those are the homes that are going to get this fuel. We're not going to get it here in Baltimore where we're broadcasting from today. You're not going to get it in Western Maryland. You're not going to get it in the Washington suburbs. You're going to get it in – it's going to affect Delmarva.
But it's going to help the pocket here. It's going to help this pocket of low supply.
So – and that's why I raised gas. How does that balance out with the rest of this? Let me ask you a question. This is not completely directed at wind. Let me just posit something here. That we've had a debate on this program about the use of solar and how that fits into the scheme of things in America. And two things came out of our program, and you may think, as in terms of the business work you do, Jay, in writing, this is as my grandfather would say, fakakta. It doesn't work, but maybe it does. Let's see. One thing is that we provide billions of dollars in subsidies every year, in addition to the $4 billion in tax breaks, to the oil industry in the United States of America every year. Supposing that money instead was invested in solar for, let's say, a neighborhood like any neighborhoods in downtown Baltimore that share roofs, whether it's the businesses downtown or communities like Bolton Hill or Charles Village or neighborhoods on the west side and the east side of this town, instead the money was invested in solar panels for homes that shared that shared solar. Is that the way to go? Does that balance out wind? I mean, what do we think about where we get the energy we need for the future of America that doesn't pollute our waterways, that doesn't pollute the atmosphere with carbon?
Oh, I think that's a brilliant idea. On two counts. I think it's a brilliant idea to take away the subsidies that the oil companies get, which they shouldn't be getting in the first place. And I think it's fabulous to take it and have federal taxpayers pay for more solar subsidies. I think that's great. Here's an option that you haven't mentioned to get clean, carbon-free electricity to power the country: uranium.
You're talking about nuclear power.
I'm talking about nuclear power. It's a fraught time to be talking about that right now. However,
watching the meltdown in Japan.
I don't think we should rule it out. Yeah, given what's going on in Japan, these are old plants in Japan that have many well documented design flaws. I still think that we can build safe nuclear power plants with passive safety systems. The kind of safety systems that the Fukushima plant does not have. I mean, it's crazy to have your plant safety depend on electrical power to have pumps to pump in the water when you might not have that. But we can get around this. Humans are dumb, but they do learn after centuries and decades. And I think we can get it right. Brad may have other thoughts.
Brad Evener.
Well, we can build safer nuclear power plants, but that makes them more expensive. And I'm a little surprised, Jay, from a business perspective. I mean, let's look at Calvert Cliffs 3. You know, there are two reactors down at Calvert Cliffs. Some companies want to build a third one. Price tag of that is above $10 billion. Now, that's a lot of money. And that's only possible after billions of dollars in federal subsidies.
Yeah.
A few years ago, the federal government authorized $13 billion of subsidies for the nuclear power industry, and the estimate was that it might help build 6 or 12 reactors. Now, again, imagine that $13 billion going to solar power. It would be transformative. So people say nuclear is cheap. I wonder what they're reading, because it's not. Continuing to operate our existing nuclear power plants is one of the cheapest things. Building new nuclear power plants is the most expensive, more expensive than offshore wind power.
And let me clarify. I'm not suggesting that Maryland get into the nuclear power business. If Constellation and Electricité de France, as they were planning to do, wanted to build a new reactor in Calvert Cliffs with their own money and their own risk, terrific. I'm not suggesting that BGE go ahead and sign a contract and get that thing built. Brad's right. They are expensive. But in the sort of global perspective that you were talking about, maybe it shouldn't be ruled out.
Is it – were you about to say something? Right. Is it folly to think – is it Oz behind the curtain to think that states can do this? States can do the wind power? Coming back to that for a minute before we come back to where – coming back to where we started. I mean, are we kind of – is it really an absurd notion, Brad, even though that we should think states should be doing this? I mean, to competing against Delaware. Oh, Delaware's doing it. New Jersey's doing it. We have to do it. Virginia should do it. I mean, is it folly to think the states should be doing this? Is that part of the problem of the argument that it's too expensive for us to do it? It's not worth the buck per pound for us to do it, unless we are doing it regionally or nationally.
Well, I mean, in one sense, if not us, whom? And if not now, when, right? So, you know, you're waiting for Congress to take care of this problem for you. But then if all these states do the state regulates our utilities. So it makes perfect sense for the state to tell the utilities, think a little longer term, please. Sign a long-term contract to make the economics of this work out so that the wind power company can build the thing. That is a perfectly sensible public policy thing to do. To have a bunch of states doing it, even better. And then there is some backing from the federal government. There are loan guarantees that exist for offshore wind power. There is the U.S. Department of Interior spending a lot of time on the permitting question. They control, you know, who gets the lease for these areas. So they're working on that. The competition between states is an interesting question, though, that you brought up. And there is this feeling now that, you know, if we don't do this, we're going to lose out. And that's about the jobs. Where are the manufacturing hubs going to be for this new industry? And on that, I think Maryland's in the sweet spot. We have Massachusetts and Delaware going ahead of us on offshore wind power. The first states out there are going to have to develop the supply chain, figure out a few kinks and how to get the parts and all that sort of thing, and it will be more expensive for them. Then we might be behind New Jersey. We're kind of tied with New Jersey for third place. But we can still market ourselves and make the strong case that we're a leader here. We're among the first states developing this and attract manufacturers here.
Manufacturers of what?
Manufacturers of the hundreds of components that go into a wind turbine, not to mention the steel. I mean, a big portion of the cost of these turbines is just the raw steel. Every one of those turbines is going to contain 300 tons of steel.
Wow.
Multiply that by 120 turbines, you've got a huge amount of steel. In Massachusetts, where Cape Wind is finally going forward, they just put in the order for the steel. It's the biggest single steel order in the eastern United States in decades.
So what will that do for us in Dundalk and steel in Baltimore?
Hopefully they'll get that contract.
What will it do?
It's hard to tell. I mean, it's a global economy. There's no reason, unless there's even more expensive subsidies built into this than there already are, there's no reason why Maryland should get the manufacturing or Dundalk should get the orders. It may. It might help. It certainly wouldn't hurt the steel economy, but I don't think it's a reason. It by itself is not a reason to go build these things, and it's really not even much of a bell or a whistle to go in. I think the local economic benefits of this are probably going to be exaggerated, as they usually are when you get to projects like this. It sounds great. Jobs, orders, but it's going to make sense for the developers of this project to buy and build these things where they can get the best deal for the least money, and that doesn't necessarily mean money. You could build something that doesn't necessarily mean Maryland. You could build something into the contract that would require Maryland sourcing that would just raise the cost for the contract and for the Maryland ratepayers that have to pay for these things.
Well, there is something in the legislature. You can't actually require it because that would violate the Constitution, but you can encourage the proposals to include local sourcing, and that is in the bill. So the PSC will give some preference to the wind power companies that as part of their bids say we're going to develop jobs locally. But then we've already seen progress on this with a company called AC Wind. I mean, I've been out there saying, commit to this and they'll come. You know, you say you're going to build this stuff and then those manufacturers will listen and they'll set up shop. That's what happened in the Plains, in Nebraska and in Iowa, where they've been building a lot of wind turbines on farmland. And now they're making the turbines there. I was sort of expecting the same thing here. You got to kind of start building it, and then they'll gradually come. And then in the middle of this, before we even pass this bill, there's a company that announces they're going to set up a blade manufacturing factory in Salisbury. There's an old boatyard. It used to make the Streamliner boats, is that the name of it? The big hulled fiberglass molding factory that's been idle. Hundreds of highly skilled people out of work. Some guy's investing money right now. John Conjato said, I'm going to buy that facility, partner with the U.S. leader in fiberglass construction to come in, set it up, train everybody, put those people back to work, and it'll be made locally. And the thing he likes most about that is the skilled workforce. These are people who will build it right the first time. You don't have to import things from China and then have to do it again because they weren't done right.
So, two quick questions, because I think as we round this out, I mean, the one thing that's popped in my head is we're thinking about steel and making steel for wind turbines or anything else. How funky is that for the environment? I mean, what does that do? The record of Bethlehem Steel and the steel companies and what they've left behind and the cancer rates in places like, especially Turner Station, an African American neighborhood in this community, have been pretty high. And a lot of that is directly people pointing – well, we don't have the proof, but they're pointing their fingers at steel.
You know, I've had this debate in my own head for a number of years because it's not just steel. It's a lot of manufacturing. It pollutes and it causes the workers and others around them to get sick. But at the same time, if we don't do it here – in one hand, it's the economy. You know, we've lost almost all those manufacturing jobs. We should for the sake of our economy – I'm a Marylander like anyone else. I want a strong economy. And we need to keep building things or else what's the economy built on? But number two, if those factories shut down, they're moving to India and Indonesia and China where the environmental safeguards are even worse. And then you need to transport the stuff here. It's a net loss. So – the permitting has been better since some of the worst problems at Bethlehem Steel. The worst things won't happen. Some bad things will still happen. But, look, I'm not moving to Montana to a cabin. I want to figure out how to do this.
I might pretty soon. I'm not sure. it's coming back to where we began. I mean, so this debate is going to be raging over the next 4 or 5 days in Annapolis over whether to build. What will it come down to? And just give us a sense. I mean, you're really thinking, politically, what does it come down to?
Well, part of what it's going to come down to is convincing the legislature that it won't be an excessive cost on Maryland ratepayers.
And your argument is that it will be.
I think it will, and I think it will. It won't be insupportable. We can, let me take that back. Nothing is, the word what's affordable and what's not affordable is a totally relative term. And Maryland could afford to do this. My argument is just that this is not the most affordable way, the most efficient, economically attractive way to get to where we want to go. O'Malley now is trying to sell this based on his $2 a month excess charge cap. I have no idea how he can do that except by using what policy wonks and economists call a magic asterisk, which is saying, we'll just put language in the bill saying that it won't cost that much, even though we have no idea what the true cost is going to be, even though there's 100 different variables that could raise the cost. I want to know, how do they know it's not going to be $2 a month? It's either going to do one of two things. Either this is for residential ratepayers, the $2 a month cap. It's possible they could shift the cost onto commercial and industrial ratepayers. Talking about the health of Sparrow's Point in Dundalk, this is the last thing they need is more expensive electricity. Now, there are, as Brad can tell you, there's language in the bill that would cap surcharges that industry would have to pay. But capping the residential cost makes me wonder where in the balloon it's being pushed out elsewhere. Or the other effect it's going to have is it'll make it less attractive for developers to come in and bid on this project. It could be similar to what happened with the slots legislation where they decided, okay, slots developers, you're going to get a lot less of a piece of the pie here than slots casinos get in other states. And what was the effect? People just – a lot fewer people bid. Maryland didn't get the competition they sought. And so that's where the politics is going to come down. I suspect that this $2 a month cap is cosmetic and not really real.
Brad.
You ask what this is coming down to. What's the main factor in whether this bill passes or not? And I think it's whether legislators can really understand that the cap is a cap. It's a threshold beyond which the PSC will not approve any contract. If the wind power companies look at this and they say, we can't do it for that price, they don't bid. Or if they bid and the PSC determines actually those bids are higher than our threshold price, they'll deny all the bids and we'll have no wind project. This legislation doesn't require a wind farm. It requires a process, an open bidding process for companies to competitively come in with the lowest price and the best project to compete for it. And if they're good enough, then we'll get a wind project, a wind farm. So right now, legislators are, this is complicated. It's, like any big bill, it's tricky. You have to understand all the ins and outs and how it would work and really trust that it will work. And if we're able to convince them, to make them understand how this threshold cap will really make sure that the cost won't go out of control, then I think we win the bill.
And you think they won't?
I think that they're spending a lot of time right now asking a lot of hard questions, a lot of good questions to understand exactly how this will work, and I think that they will accept it and pass the bill.
This has been really fascinating. I do appreciate that both of you taking all this time with our listeners here in Baltimore and across the state of Maryland to the Eastern Shore to kind of wrestle with this, because it's a huge issue, and it's one of the most important ones I think the state legislature faces. Jay Hancock, business columnist for the Baltimore Sun, and Brad Huebner, Executive Director of Environment Maryland. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com.